The official start time is 10:05, but we're starting at 10:03 because we care about time management, I've been told. I'm learning. My name is Jane Bowman. I'm the Vice President of Marketing and Strategic Partnerships at the Boston Globe. We are so proud, and I'm so grateful that we are part of this really important conference. The name of this session is Namaste, so Namaste. Thank you. Loosely translated, I honor the light in you, which is the light in me. I think for today, I'm just going to change it. I'm going a little off script. I honor the power of Anita Hill in you. That is the power of Anita Hill in me. So thank you for being here. And keep that power, please. I'm here to introduce Laura Vanderkam. I had the pleasure of being at a dinner that she spoke at a couple of nights ago. You are in for a treat. You are in for a great learning experience, and you are in for someone who might call bullshit on you. Just a warning. It says in my notes that she's the author of several books. It's really many, because I hear what it takes to write a book, and that is not easy. I know how she does it, what the most successful people do before breakfast, that's sitting on my dining room table. I'm going to read that. And 168 hours. No, I'm making time for this. It's a choice. I learned. Her work has appeared in publications including the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Fast Company, USA Today. She lives outside of Philly. She has four children. She has, this is what I learned at dinner also, she has a fish who just died. I'm sorry. And her children want a dog. That's a lot. So listen carefully. The other thing that I ask you is at the end of the session, do yourselves a favor, go down to the bookstore. She's doing a book signing directly following this, and I tell you it will be life-changing. So I leave you with Laura.
Thank you so much, Jane. So if people want to tweet about this panel, hashtag just mass women, I think. I'm at L. Vanderkam if you want to tag me. I'll pretend you're not checking email on your phones. Right? I have mine to check the time. I am not checking email too. We are all going to be beating up on the phrase work-life balance today. Apparently none of us really like that phrase. I don't really like that phrase either. Instead, we are going to be talking about choices, because life is a series of choices, and different people make different choices at different times. And my personal crusade is to make sure that people make choices based on adequate information, because I think people make all kinds of choices based on stories we tell ourselves. But if we re-examine some of those stories, many turn out to be problematic. And our panel today is going to talk about the choices they have made over time and how they have challenged conventional wisdom in order to achieve happiness or inner peace, I guess, in keeping with the theme of this panel, or whatever else you ladies are going for, right? So I write about choices through the lens of time, because life is lived in hours. And so what we do with our lives is going to be a function of how we spend our hours. And I became fascinated with this topic of time several years ago when I realized something that is dumbfoundingly obvious in retrospect, but still profound, which is that we all have the exact same amount of time. We all have the same 24 hours in a day, 168 hours in a week, 8,760 hours in a year, or 8,784 in this particular year. Make sure you use those extra 24 hours. And so when you see people doing amazing things with their professional lives, who are also doing amazing things with their personal lives, like our panel here, it is not because they have more time than the rest of us. And so maybe it's because they are allocating their time in interesting and creative ways over the years. And we can learn from that. We can learn from the choices that they have made. So one thing I want to make sure that we learn today is that the obvious choice we all usually talk about, namely work versus family, is not the only choice that is out there. And sometimes it is not even the choice that we think it is. Before we label something a harsh and inevitable trade-off and make sweeping pronouncements about our lives, or even worse, sweeping pronouncements about other people's lives, fun as that often is, I think we need to get the right perspective. People often tell me, you know, there aren't enough hours in the day to get to everything I need to do, let alone everything I want to do. And I totally agree. there are not enough hours in the day. But fortunately, if we take a slightly bigger perspective, I think we can find time for the things that matter to us, certainly over the course of our lives. Maybe not in one day, but over the course of our lives. And frankly, I honestly think even a week is enough time to make progress on a lot of stuff that matters. Because here are some numbers for you. 168 hours in a week. 24 times 7, 168 hours. If you are working 40 hours a week, so full-time job, sleeping 8 hours a night, so that is 56 hours per week, that leaves 72 hours for other things. Kind of a lot of time, right? Even with a full-time job, you say, oh, but of course I work more than that. I work 50 hours a week. Okay, well, that leaves 62 hours for other things. I work 60 hours a week. Well, that leaves 52 hours for other things. You say you work more than 60 hours a week. Well, I may have to call that BS on you, right? There was once a study that compared people's estimated work weeks with time diaries, found that people claiming 75 plus hour weeks were off by about 25 hours. You can guess in which direction, right? So remember that next time you're in one of those scintillating cocktail party conversations about people's 80-hour work weeks. But anyway, even if you're working 60 hours a week, that leaves 52 hours for other things. So the idea that we can't find 3 hours to exercise or 2 hours to volunteer, time to hang out with our family or our friends, is a wee bit problematic. So I hope we're looking at our choices through the lens of adequate information. And I particularly see this limited perspective on when it comes to work and life and women's life choices, right? As women, we often have this story that work and family are at odds, right? We got the balance metaphor, one goes up, the other must go down. That's the whole thing with the scale, right? One goes up, the other must go down. But if you look at historic time diary data, how people spend their time now and in the past, we find out a couple of things. First, women spend more time working for pay now than they did in the 1950s and 60s. Everyone knows that, right? But intriguingly, women also spend more time interacting with their children now than they did in the 1950s and 60s. And people are like, how on earth is that possible? Remember, we gotta go do our balance thing, right? How is that possible? One must go up, the other must go down. But the truth is, life is vast, and those are not the only two categories that women spend time on. No one spends all 168 hours at work, even if it sometimes feels like it. Nobody spends all 168 hours on childcare either, even if I'm up at 5 a.m. with my toddler, it also feels like it, especially when he's dumping the entire thing of fish food in the tank and killing the fish. But anyway, so there's many categories. So both can go up and other things can go down. You want to know the major thing that went down between the 1960s and now? Housework. We all discovered the life-changing magic of not tidying up, right? And so that's a choice we can make, right? As we're surveying our choices, people often tell me, well, but Laura, it costs money to outsource household chores, which is true, but it costs nothing to lower your standards. I would highly recommend that. But seriously, we have all kinds of stories we tell ourselves about things we have to do with our time without recognizing that these are choices. And housework certainly plays into that. I was recently looking at the time diary kept by a lawyer who had worked very late one night, consciously, in order to have some time off at a different point. And her husband was with the kids, and they'd been having a grand old time. But he had never gotten the memo that when she comes home from work, the house is supposed to be spotless, right? That's a memo maybe some women walk around with. Not a lot of men have that memo. So she comes home, there's a mess in the kitchen, toys all over the floor. Late at night, what does she start doing? Picking it up, right? And I look at her and say, well, why? Why are you doing that? Is there going to be an 11 p.m. home inspection? Like, is somebody going to come around and give you demerits if there are toys on the floor? No. The toys are just going to come out again the next morning, but you are never going to get that hour back. And so particularly when we're telling ourselves stories of things we have to do, we should look at those stories and ask ourselves two questions. First, where is this story coming from? And second, does this story serve me? So here's just one example, one last example of how I have learned to be comfortable with choices. Before I had kids, I read a lot of stories about women's work-life choices, and many of these are written in an incredibly angsty tone. And generally, the format they take is that our heroine is this hard-charging professional, and she's doing her level best to combine work and family. But then a series of dark moments leads to a tipping point where she misses the soccer game due to a late flight. And so this leads to an epiphany that she must dial down, scale back, opt out, She must join with this Greek chorus of the disillusioned, chanting that women can't have it all, right? Well, now I'm a parent, and I miss soccer games all the time. You wanna know why? It's because I have four children. And when one has a soccer game, another has a swim meet on the other side of town at the exact same time. But funny, no one looks at that hard choice moment and tells me I need to get rid of the other kid. It's only work that's ever the choice that's the problem, right? But either way, I'm still not at that game, right? So if I don't feel guilty about having more than one kid, which I don't, then maybe I don't need to feel guilty about other things that lead to the exact same outcome. So either way, we just have to do the best we can. All of life is choices, and we just have to do the best we can. So with that in mind, I want to turn to our illustrious panel here. I'm going to ask them each to introduce themselves briefly, starting with Heather.
Hi, thanks very much. That was really fascinating. Although as I was listening to you, I kept thinking, but I'm one of those ones that wants to get 90 minutes out of the 60 minutes. Anyway.
Be honest with ourselves.
I've had a career, as many of you have, that was completely unpredictable. I started out in politics and government. I thought that's where my career would be. I was working on Capitol Hill and then in the White House. And then my president lost, and I was out of a job. So I then came back home to Boston, went to work at the Harvard Kennedy School. After 17 years in and out doing presidential campaigns, losing most of the time, decided I could be at Harvard the rest of my life at the rate I was going, and decided to make a really big career pivot, which I'll talk about later, into the private sector, into banking, no less. I did 10 years at Citizens Bank as head of corporate affairs, which is all their charitable giving, communications, government relations, etc. And made another career pivot after 10 years, thinking I was going to go work on the Hillary campaign at long last in 2008, but then there was no general election, so went back into banking, but started a digital bank. Able Banking, still out there, great charitable component to it, fabulous. Then went into the nonprofit sector to run the Kennedy Library for a couple of years, and now I'm back at the Kennedy School at Harvard working on a women's leadership program until I figure out my next move. So lots of sectors has been my career. And the other thing I should mention is Lynn and I just realized we are not in the speaker's bios because
I just found them off the street.
We're longtime board members, so you can find us under the board bios if you want more details.
So, Tish.
Well, hi, thank you very much for having me. I'm Tish Creasy, and I'm part of Merck KGaA at Darmstadt, Germany, and a friend of Renee's who's on the board here.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Oh, can you hear me now?
Just project.
So I'm Tish Creasy. I'm part of Merck KGaA of Darmstadt, Germany, MilliporeSigma in the United States. I'm a friend of Renee's, who's in the back there, who's on the board. I'm a PhD chemist by training. unlike our other colleagues, I've kind of just stayed in the path of science my entire career. With a variety of companies. I started in graduate school in the late 70s, which was an interesting experience and certainly a different time. And I'm really, really, I don't have any children, so I haven't gone through the soccer games or the swim meets or anything, but I'm very pleased to be here, so thank you for having me.
And Lynn, let's hear from you.
Hi, I'm Lynn Tinney. I'm the Vice President of Channels for Riverbed. I have a board member, but my career has been almost always in technologies, but I've changed functions. I've been in sales, marketing, operations, channels. It's kind of like, what hat do they have here, Lynn? So I'm a longtime Boston resident, and I know lots of choices to move different places to further the career, but I knew that it was important for me to stay one place and keep one thing consistent, and it's a choice that I revel in. And so Boston's home for me.
Boston is home. Awesome. And so I'm going to ask everyone to talk a little bit about choices that they have made in life. So Heather, I wonder if you can talk about a choice or trade-off you made and its impact on you and your family. And if you would do anything differently looking back on that now.
So the choice I wanted to talk about was the one I referenced in my bio, which was after a really successful career in politics and government and then 17 years at Harvard's Kennedy School, where I had done four different jobs, ended up running the forum. I was there in the early years when we were just building the school. It was the most exciting place to be. And I had been at Harvard, well, I got there in the early 80s and was there through the 90s. And I really had, I think the last year I was there, I had 11 heads of state that I hosted in the forum. I knew a lot of the faculty throughout the campus. I had this very prestigious, exciting job. I used to say it was the best job on campus, but I had done that last job for 7 years. And I hit a milestone. I turned 40. And I just thought to myself, if I don't leave now, I'll be here the rest of my life. And I think change is good. I think it's important to grow and learn. And I wasn't learning a lot more anymore, although I was having fun every single day. And I started looking for jobs and just kind of fell into this opportunity at Citizens Bank, which at the time was the third largest bank in New England. I don't even think they had offices in Cambridge. First of all, nobody leaves Harvard. Nobody certainly leaves to go to a little bank that people haven't really heard of, which is what it was at the time. But I just thought, well, you know, it'd be good to learn something. It'd be like getting a business school degree, and I had never read a balance sheet. I knew nothing about banking. And all of a sudden, I found myself as the top woman at this company, which at the time had 10,000 employees. I was in the management team, six white men. The other woman was the head of HR. And one of the biggest challenges for me, it was a huge cultural shift, let alone huge learning shift professionally. But one of the biggest challenges for me was there was not another, I had children in grade school, there was not another woman like me in senior management, let alone on the management team. The CEO had our weekly management meetings at 7 a.m. in Providence, which meant as a mother, Sunday afternoons, my life stopped because I was getting up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning to leave by 5:30 to go off to these management meetings an hour and a half away. I live in the Boston area. And worse, when I got there, I had these men sitting around the table looking at me as follows. Woman, Democrat, they hate politics, they hate Democrats. From, this is gross generalizations, but from Harvard, why are you even working? And what I realized was there were a lot of men that I worked with at Harvard, but their wives had careers. So they were kind of looking at me like, well, your husband must be a loser, because what are you doing? You know, why are you killing yourself like this, right? So it was really a very hard cultural shift, and I felt like I had traded all this. I was a big fish in a pretty big pond, and now I'm in this little tiny bank, and nobody respects me, nobody gets me, nobody's helping me. Yet, here's the trade-off part. The moment I left the Kennedy School at Harvard, Senator Kennedy called me and asked me to be on the board. Now, I had been a staff member for 17 years. That never would have happened if I had stayed at Harvard, even in another job. And as I had mentioned earlier, over time, I learned so much about business. It was like getting a business school degree. We did executive ed at the Harvard Business School, so it was a great professional growth opportunity. I learned about management, which you certainly don't learn in academia, much about management. And most importantly, and I'll come back to this later, I got a network. I developed a network of friends, women, neighbors, a book club that we were talking about. It's a virtual book club. We don't read books. It's just really about how...
It's not really a club, then.
It's the Massachusetts Women's Forum I was elected into and found the Massachusetts Conference for Women with Renee and the other board members. And that has helped me enormously because you, as a woman, women are still breaking paths, and you can't do it alone. And so here I am all these years later to say it was painful, it was hard. It was hard on my family, it was hard on my, on my career, certainly, because I had to prove myself every day for many years. But I look back on it, and it was pivotal, and it was really great for me. And the icing on the cake was all the women that I'm now diving into lots of women's issues at Harvard.
Wonderful. And so, Tish, how about you? What's a choice or trade-off that you made in your career? And can you talk a little bit about that and what you might change or not change about it?
You know, I think that probably some of the biggest choices I've made, and sometimes they're right and right. You know, it's not always a trade-off, you know, but you're making choices between right and right, is really relocating. I think that's the toughest thing sometimes to do. you know, because you're obviously taking family with you, or you're leaving family and you're going to a place you have to reestablish connections and networks. And but I've relocated 6 times in my career, so it's an average of about 5 years per location. And I do have to say that that's probably, you know, one of the single biggest things that you have to give up. Am I going to go and advance my career or do something different? You know, take on a different challenge, whether it's in operations, whether it's in sales and marketing, and just do something that you might consider fun. I think that's it, and not everybody's in the position to do that. So I found myself fortunate to be in that position, but it's also quite difficult at times, really, to make those choices to leave. And I think another interesting choice that, you know, proved to be a big challenge was actually in graduate school, you know, a long time ago, in a land far away. You know, sometimes it was you're just slave. I mean, it's working sort of slavishly, literally, to achieve, to defend and achieve and really train. But that's something that I wouldn't change. As hard as it was at times, and you give up everything, but you go into it knowing I'm giving up everything that's normal, and you just work slavishly to meet that objective. But it was great. It was total immersion. It was fun. It was just, you learned how to think. It was a time that was absolutely one of the best times, and I would never, ever make a different choice. Yeah. And I think in educating now, especially with things that are available online, just continually to educate whatever you're interested in. It might be history, it might be science, you know, it just might be learning some subject. You know, always continue that. I think that's a choice I make and how I choose to spend my time, reading and things, but that's always good.
That's wonderful. So hard work. There are trade-offs, but it's often very fun to work very hard towards something, towards a goal that really matters to you. Yeah. And then, Lynn, I wonder if you could talk about the same thing as well, the trade-off you've made.
I thought this was a great question, because I think we come upon these every day. I mean, do I have the decaf or the...
Very monumental
decision,
by the way.
I shouldn't have the decaf. I'm going for a cookie. Probably the biggest one for me, and this was visceral for me. I was... very proud of my career, I still am. It's kind of my little cherry for myself. And I was making a job change, I was interviewing, and I had 2 offers literally sitting on my dining room table the very same Friday, and I had to make a decision by Monday morning. And one was huge title, a whole lot more money, a lot of travel, and I took the other one. And it was hard. It was a great job, the one I took. It was for a company that I wanted to work for. It also put me, it was HQ'd in California, so I have a family in California, so I knew I would get to see family more, which was enormously important to me. And I made the decision it was the first time I deprioritized my career. And having done 20 years of, you know, up, like do more, which I loved every instant of it, I finally went, I just need to be healthy for the next 5 or 6. I just need to give myself a little bit more back. And I would never change it, because I really believe that on paper, that other role looked like the role to have. I know in my heart, in my belly, that role that I took was the best role for me, and I was enormously more successful at it because I looked at myself as a whole person. And I spent 6 years at that wonderful company, and I've taken my career since then elsewhere. But that was a very, you know, visceral Friday morning decision. You got to sign the paper by Monday. You got to make that hard phone call to the guy that's really coming after you. And there's not a day that I look back and go, wow, how did I even have the guts to make that decision? And I will also tell you, I signed that paper, and it was a Monday, and I wasn't working that Monday. And at lunchtime, I sat down, and I bawled like a baby. And I don't say that to, you know, add drama to the message, but that's how much of a core, it was such a left turn for me. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, I think it's courage. You know, you had courage to make your changes. You've had courage to move. That's courage. And I think it was my first time that I didn't recognize it as courage then. And that's what, when I look back at it, is when I look at it and go, where did I muster that up from? So that was a real change for me.
I'm sure the courage was there, but yes, it's the very difficult decisions we can make. And what's even harder is when they're both really good options, right? Because mm-hmm. often it's not that one's a good option, one's a bad option. That's an easy choice. It's when they're both wonderful, a plethora of choices. One of the things we want to do at this conference is make sure people have practical takeaways and notes that you're writing down, things that you can take with you. And so, Heather, as people in this audience are looking at their choices about work and life, their careers, their families, friends, communities, what are some practical takeaways that you have, ways they can think about these questions?
So I had a few stories I thought I'd share with you for takeaways based on this work-life balance question. When I was working at this bank, working day and night, everyone got in there early because they were guys. They didn't have to do their hair, makeup, kids, nothing. They just rolled out of bed and went. No wonder they did 7 a.m. meetings, right? But sometimes the little things really help you through. So I would look like this, going to work every day. Banks are sort of formal. And on the days when I didn't have the 7 a.m. meetings, I would take my daughter into work. And she would say to me, "Do you have to look like that? Can't you look like the other mothers who were going in sweatpants or whatever?" And one day I said to one of the mothers in the neighborhood, "You know, I feel so badly looking like this going in because I'd wear coats even when it was in the season." And she looked at me and said, "We all work just different hours. Don't worry about it." And it was just the kindest thing. It just sort of made me think, okay, I'm not some weirdo, and it's okay that I'm doing this. The other thing is, at one point, I was hugely stressed because I'm working so many hours. I have two young kids. And I said to a friend of mine, "I don't even have time to pay the bills." And she looked at me and said, "Why don't you get a bookkeeper? You can pay them $25 an hour, and you'll probably save it in the late fees." And just having someone come to my house 2 hours a month, I still have it. It's just saved my life. It was just a little thing that removed so much stress. So one thing is little thing. Second thing is, sometimes what you think is a sacrifice turns out for the better. So as I described, when I was at Citizens, I was working these late nights. My kids were in grade school, my daughter all day long kept saying, "Please, can't we have a dog? Please, can't we have a dog?" I couldn't take on one more thing, let alone a puppy to train. One night at 8 o'clock, I came home, and she said for the umpteenth time, "Please, can't we have a dog?" And I looked at her and I said, "Courtney, why do you need a dog?" And she said, "So I can have something to hug when you're not here." So we got a dog. And it killed me, but you know what? It gave her a level of security, and therefore me a level of security, that made my life easier. Then fast forward, 10 years later, my kids are in high school. I decide, as I mentioned earlier, I'm gonna go off and do the Hillary campaign in 2008, and I come home proudly and I say to my kids, "Guess what, I'm gonna be leaving Citizens," thinking they'd be all excited that, you know, I'd have more time for them. And they looked at me and they said, "Well, you're not gonna stay home, are you?" So just so you know, kids adjust, your families adjust, and that was a great reliever for me of all those years of guilt, that actually they were doing just fine, despite the fact that they needed a dog to get through. And then the final thing, which you touched on, which we didn't talk about this, but it's so funny, I thought of the same thing. In the name of nurturing and caring for yourself, let go of having to do everything. Mm-hmm. Men are really good at this. They delegate. They either don't notice or don't care. They just don't do all those details, like cleaning up. I would love to have an organized kitchen. I would love to be in control of my kitchen, but I'm not. And I just learned that if you could give that up, then actually this career is for you. It is, as you said, Lynn, your own little sort of cherry pick. So do the things that make you happy and that don't drag you down. You know, my mother always said, children don't remember who bathed them and fed them. They remember who they had fun with. And it's sort of the same thing for you. When I look back on it, I don't remember all the clean kitchens. I just remember being exhausted cleaning. So your perspective is right on that. And then finally, I just want to say one thing. You mentioned courage. about nurturing your soul. And maybe going a little out of balance once in a while to do that. So be fearless and have courage and take risks that expand your world for you personally. And I just want to tell you a story of someone that inspired me that did this. There's a woman that came into our lives that wanted to do something good for the world. So she decided she wanted to give someone a kidney. And you put yourself through surgery. A healthy person goes through surgery to do that. She took a month off of work to do it. She went into Mass General Hospital a few years ago and said, I don't have anyone to give a kidney to, but I want to change someone's life. I want to save someone's life. And she did that. And needless to say, we've gotten to know her. And she did that really to save her own soul. But in so doing, she inspired all of us and saved so many of ours. And she's here. So I just wanted to introduce her colleague, Lenny, as a woman of courage. Stand up, Colleen. She doesn't know I was going to do that. But to me, that's like, take courage to take care of yourself. And in so doing, you're helping a lot more people than you realize.
Wow, that is amazing. Wonderful takeaway. I'm not sure about the dog takeaway.
Yeah, right.
I think I'm going to get a dog one. But Tisha, what about you? Some practical advice for our audience here.
You know, maybe I give some advice on, because it's things that I didn't do that maybe I should have done. Plan. You know, I don't think I could be accused of really planning my career. You know, I reacted mainly to, oh, that sounds interesting, or, oh, wow, that sounds really cool, I'll try that. You know, in retrospect, maybe I should have planned a little bit more. And not that I seek it to be any different, but maybe a little bit more purposeful, or you could plan things out. So I certainly recommend people to plan. If you can, plan some things. I do emphasize some of the things that Heather had said about taking risks. I used to have this boss that would say, what are they going to do, take your shoes? You know, why not try it? You know, it's really, you know, you might lose a pair of shoes, and that's about maybe the extent of it. So for me, that always stuck with me, and that was relatively early, you know, one of my first bosses who would say that is, you know, what are they going to do, take your shoes? So try some things. I think it's, you'll find things are worth the risk. And again, so something doesn't work out, just do something else, you know. You're not paralyzed by it. So I think that's a really great thing. And as you're thinking about your career, and people do want to advance, and it is important to lots of people to do that, but it's not important to everyone. And it's incumbent upon every person to find the joy in their job, no matter what you do. To come in every day and work and think, oh, this sucks. You know, don't do that. I mean, you don't have to do that. You know, but it is, if you can't find the joy in your job, don't expect anybody to give that to you. You have to do that. So, I mean, those are kind of things. And I do find the joy in my job every day. That is one thing I am particularly passionate about. I have a great job and I enjoy every day.
That's wonderful. And I would add, if they do take your shoes, then you can go shopping for new ones, which is like actually awesome.
Not a bad thing.
And then, Len, how about you? What are some practical advice you've got?
Practical advice. So I have a couple of these. So I know there's a few people in the room that are on my team that are here, so they hear this, so it'll be redundant for them, but for the rest of it, it'll be brand new. I don't start with the email. For those of you who work, I start with what are the three things I need to get done that day. The minute you go to email, you're reactive. Boom. You're just instantly reactive. You're responding to somebody else's need. Stop. It's your day. I love what Carla, the power within us, I mean, it's a microcosm of power, but the power to say, I am not opening email until I figure out what are the three things that I'm going to get done today. And then I look at that list and I go, what's the hardest one? And I start that one. And so I live by that. I've done that since I graduated from college, which is a long, long time ago, and it has always served me well. And like before really email was out there, just to tell you how long ago that was. The other thing I do is I believe in kind of work triage. I work for a wonderful man. He supports this for our company. I mean, he's a wonderful human being to work for, not only as a leader, but also just as a straight-up human being. I could spend days upon days with this man. Nonetheless, he gets really creative sometimes, and he fires off those big, fat emails, and he wants, you know, hey, Lynn, how about this? Boom, but I'm like, okay, he's going to send me three of those before I pick up that project. Yeah, that's a great idea. Uh-huh, that's a great idea. And then the third time, I'm like, okay, maybe I better do something about it. Because he's on it, right? So I let that happen. There's this kind of natural triage that just does happen. It's just, and I don't think we allow ourselves that as much. So things prioritize themselves without you prioritizing. Just don't step in. And the third thing that I do, and this is kind of the bigger picture for me, is my meter is happy. Kind of, I like the way you started this, the life balance thing. My meter is happy. Are my boys happy? Is Jim happy? I worry less about Jim because he keeps himself happy every day. That's my husband. But am I happy? And is my day a good day? And if I had too many days that aren't happy? And those happen. I mean, you know, you're like, you get in this trough sometimes, and you're like, okay, something needs to change here. And so I think I get more frustrated at myself when I drift away from my happy bar. And all of a sudden I've had 2 weeks of the trough, and I'm like, okay, change it up, something, you know, and I offer myself the ability to do a little bit more triage. You know, the mani-pedi always works. Those elements. So those are, happy's kind of the bigger picture. Don't push yourself into reactive mode and allow yourself some triage.
Those are great bits of advice there. And I love what you're saying about having some open space in your schedule as well, that you're not filling every minute, especially with things that other people are sending at you. So right. Taking a little bit of time. I give her a gold star on productivity, by the way, to start the day with three things that are important to you and not the inbox. Because here's the funny thing. Email will expand to fill all available space. All available space. You say, like, when I finish my email, I'll get to everything else. You will never finish your email. I've actually seen this on time logs, that people are trying to get down to inbox zero and devoting vast amount of time to it, and they put the number next to it, it'll be like inbox 275, inbox 225, inbox 180. Gets down to like inbox 20, and then everyone responds from those 200 emails that they just dealt with. We're like, oh God, we're back up to inbox 500. You'll never reach the bottom of your inbox. But fortunately, the good news is that it won't say on your tombstone, she reached the bottom of her inbox. There will be the things that you've done. And so that's great advice from Lynn, to focus on those things that you're going to do, the important things at the beginning of the day, because then they will happen. And Tish, you'd mentioned something when we were talking earlier about the role of trust. And when you're making choices about work and life and what you're doing with yourself, how important it is to trust the other people you have in your life. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's great to have trusting relationships or people that you can go to for advice that you trust. You know, should I take this job? Should I not? You know, sitting there on a Friday afternoon deciding which one to sign on to. And I think, you know, a lot of your choices have to do with, have you surrounded yourself with trusting people who will tell you, you know, that really sucks. Or, you know, that's not a good idea. Or that's not you. Or you should go for it. And to have either those mentors or people that you can trust, whether they're family or friends, I think it's really important to have that network of folks that can, you trust them and they can be very honest with you.
Yeah.
Super important.
And Heather, I mean, how do you know whose advice to take, right? As you're making choices, big choices about your life, how should you figure out whose advice is good and whose advice you should just ignore?
So, just to echo what Tish said, certainly you've got to have people that you trust in your life that will tell you the truth. So for me, that has been a combination of my mentors and my book club, which we were talking about earlier. We don't read books. We just,
Very
honest with each other. And that really helps. But I'm also a big gut person. You know if something coming at you resonates or doesn't. you know what's right and wrong. And a lot of us, as we grow older, try to justify one thing or another. And the older I get, the less I'm into justification. I'm just like, no, it doesn't feel right. I've got to sort of sort this out. So that's where I go.
How about you, Lynn?
So on the honesty, how important trust and honesty is. So first of all, I think there's a spectrum of this. You know, what are you going to, if someone's directing your life decisions, those are the people that are most close to you. But sometimes you just need to trust people a little, right? It's that young employee. You can see that young lion in them, man or woman, whatever. And you have to kind of give them the ball. And there's trust in that, and your name's on it, right? And you have to support them, but you also have to let them know, I'm trusting you here. Like, so there's this, I feel like there's a spectrum of trust. I thought this was a phenomenal question because there's just different measures of it. I think one of the things that I had learned as a manager, and this was hard for me because I am, you know, the A-plus personality. Everything's under my control. We all do what I want to do, right? My house. There was a little humor in that, but
yeah.
Thank you.
Do your employees say that?
Yeah. I'm sure they would. But there's this, the getting used to delegating, and as I have managers who work for me, I'm like, you need to learn to delegate. And I say that from a position of, I'm not good at this. And there is trust in delegation. It also makes you surround yourself with people that you can trust, and that's a big leap. Like, who are you hiring? Who are you working with by influence? Who are you pulling together that maybe aren't on your team? So that you have, if you will, kind of a landscape of people that you have an opportunity to trust so that you can give them that little project. Not the big one, you know, not babysitting your kids. The little ones, and you know, how can you pepper out all those little ones so that your life is a little bit more manageable? And so there's a spectrum of trust on this one.
Yeah, Heather, you want to?
I completely agree, and I just want to add something on the inverse of that. As you're building your career, one of the things, as I look back on it, that I didn't do enough of, but it's important to convey in the people you're working with and the people you're reporting to your trust in them.
Yes.
You know, we think it, but we don't often say it, and it's powerful. So I would just add
that's
that
a great
it.
Point, Heather. There's a that communication piece of I'm trusting you. One, it's such a vote of confidence to any one of them, to someone that you work for, when you're saying I need you to help me do this. I'm trusting you to help me do this. And these are people that are above you. There are people who are, if you will, on, you know, that you're in your sphere of influence that are your peers. Hey, I'm trusting you to help me with this. And then there's that person that's working for you if you're in a management position. You got the ball on this one, you know.
So this is how guys do it in banking. They golf. And they get to know each other and they get to trust each other. And that's, you know, that's what golf is,
right?
Really.
But you can do that with a book club, too.
Exactly.
Even if you don't read the books.
And it's more fun.
Exactly.
There's one.
You can golf, too. I mean, if you want to pick that up as well or go running together or whatever it is you choose to do. And I love what you were saying about having the A-plus personality, because I'm just taking a wild guess that we got a lot of A-plus personalities in this room. And I heard a wonderful bit of advice from somebody once that she had a group of A-plus friends, and they all talked to each other and said, you know, we could be A-minus on a few things. We could maybe even be B-plus on a few things in our lives. So we can, not everything has to be A-plus.
Cookie, I'm a C.
You're a C on that. And so figure out those things in your life that you want to be A plus on, and then the things where you can be C, the things where you can be A minus on even, that would be okay. You know, 92% is just fine sometimes. I would want to open it up to a little of some questions now if we have people who want to do that. Jane,
and
will lead that.
Come on up to the microphones on either side.
Yeah, it might just be easier to form lines. This is your chance to ask those questions and say, fix my life. So come up and get your life fixed. Here we go. Not that you all need your lives fixed, I'm sorry. Let's start on my right, your left.
Hi. My husband and I are kind of at a turning point right now where we're trying to decide if we want to have a family or not. for a number of different reasons. We're kind of on the fence. So, and I'm struggling with how that's going to impact my career, and what kind of impact it's going to have on the balance of my life right now. Do you have any thoughts on what kind of considerations you had when it came down to either starting a family or choosing to not have children? Are there any insights that you might have on how that impacted your career or what considerations you made?
Have that baby. let me be very, I say that this classic Lynn, right? Just boom, there's your answer.
Any other questions?
Any questions?
Not that one.
I will tell you, and because I say that in a way that I went through that thought, and it was not small. We were pregnant, and we didn't even know we were pregnant, so that kind of defeated the conversation. However, we struggled with that. Yeah, that's also a classic one. You get that baby in your arms, and there isn't a priority, a balance sheet, a meeting. Have that baby. Everything will find its place.
I would say, interestingly with that, I mean, people say, oh, how does it affect your career? And I remember, I was filling out something for my 10th reunion from college, and you had to fill out a survey on how life choices and how having children had affected your career on one day, and it said major effect, not so much effect, or whatever. And I was thinking I should say not so much effect, because it hasn't really been negative or anything like that. And I'm like, well, no, wait, it's had a huge effect. It's had a huge positive effect. Because it turns out that writing about time management and productivity, having it from the perspective of being a working mother, gives me a platform to talk about it in a way that I'm not sure people would necessarily follow as much if I didn't have that. And so my kids gave me more things to write about. I mean, I did not have four children as a personal branding platform, but it hasn't hurt to be able to say that. And so I say sometimes life has possibilities that you can't even imagine. And that doesn't mean that we should necessarily have children or not have children. I'm of the camp that if you think you might want them, go for it, because it won't get easier later. That's up to each individual person to decide. But sometimes the possibilities are there that we just can't see.
So just quickly, go by your gut, for sure. Mm-hmm. I agree with it. I echo. It's life-changing. It's phenomenal. It's made me better in my career. But go by your gut. But when you make a decision, whatever it is, be confident about it. If you choose to get pregnant, don't go to the office apologizing for it. You own it, and you enjoy it, and you because you deserve that. And if you don't, same thing.
Yeah. That is so cute.
Thank you. So, hi, I'm Caitlin. I've been 3 years in my department, and I started right out of college at a really high caliber, and I've taken on new responsibilities, and my work has come to expect a really high work performance from me, which isn't a problem. I deliver. It's awesome. But going back to the opening remarks, Carla Harris said is your performance in a new standard of excellence, in that how do you make the choice where I'm 24, I'm married, obviously kind of the same thing, but not really. How do I make the choice in my career? What strategies have you guys used to say, I'm going to prioritize this project, or even going to your boss and saying, I can't handle this, you're giving me too much? How do you really approach that conversation moving on in your life? I clearly have a long time left in my career, but to start now is really important for me because I don't want to get overburdened, overloaded, and then have this conversation 10 years from now, and it's way too late.
So I want to tell you one of my favorite stories about this. So, and there's a real gender difference in this story. If it were, I would venture to say, if you were a 24-year-old man, you wouldn't be asking the question, right? This is what men do. They go to their bosses, and they say, happy to do this. I'm going to need more support.
Right.
I'm going to need more money. I'm going to unabashedly.
Yeah.
Quick story that was really insightful for me. I had at Citizens a dozen senior vice presidents, mostly in communications, so mostly women. And I noticed that these women, when we'd go to the management team and talk about promotions, everyone loved them. Everyone thought they did superb jobs. No one was recommending them for a substantial raise or promotion. And I was trying to figure out why. So we did a retreat to help empower these women and help show them how to lead and how to project themselves and all the rest. And as I was going off, I said to one of the male vice chairmen, you know, I'm doing this because these women are so awesome. He said, oh, yeah, 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 they are. They're fabulous. And I said, but they're not getting ahead in this company. And I said they're working so hard, more hours than most of their male peers. And he looked at me, said something I will never forget, which was, well, you know, it's true. If you're too busy doing all the time, you can't think. And if you can't think, you can't lead. Yeah. So what that told me was they were hurting themselves by dotting every I and crossing every T. Right. So go get yourself the resources you need and assure them you can manage, because you can.
And I want to give you, that's excellent. That's dead on. When I mentor and develop all of my employees, men and women, don't get wrapped up into the titles, don't get wrapped up into where you are, make impact. What your spectrum of impact is the top priority for you, if that's what you want. If this is an impact that is, you know, this much, this many dollars, or this little niche thing for the company or the project that you're working on, but it's visible, okay, great. You want the one that's got this much impact, trust me, it will get visible. And don't worry about titles, but Heather is dead on right. Don't think that you're gonna, and I'm pointing, I don't mean to, don't think that you can do it alone. I think that one of the crimes that we commit for ourselves is we get these assignments and we're doing it. You're doing it solo, and you need to raise your hand and go, yeah, I'm all about that. I need two bodies to help, and who's helping me over here? They don't need to report to you. I want them tapped and aligned. I need their name aligned and on my team, either organizationally or not organizationally. Ask for it. You will get it. I can guarantee it.
Yeah.
Thank you. One more.
Hi. This is kind of going back to what Heather said about, you know, having that mom guilt and later on realizing your kids were okay. What are some good coping, I have a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, so what are some good coping mechanisms that you use to kind of get over that at the time where you're experiencing it? And then what were some good explanations that you had to your child who's going to question, you know, so-and-so's mom drops him off at school or picks him up at 2? Like, what is a good response?
So you tell them about your job. You tell them how important it is to you and to your family. And again, I'm big on, you know, no apologies. Unabashedly, right? You know, you share with them that you wish you could, and that you'll try and make days once in a while where you can do that. But I mean, that's why I love the story about my kids saying, "Well, you're not going to be home," because it just left off this layer for me. I think they're proud of me now. They were happy that I had a career. But you know, as children, in 5 and 1-year-olds, it's hard to see that. But I think they pick up on what you project. So if you're projecting guilt, that's going to make them feel bad too. Not that you shouldn't feel it, because we all do. But I think you want to sort of explain to them why you're doing it and why it's exciting and why it matters. It's kind of the philosophy around take your daughter to work day, although I want to take, I have a new idea about let's take men to work to see what women go through every day.
Take them to your house, and they can go through the process of getting everyone out the door.
See what that's like. But yes, so that would be my advice. And the little things that we talked about: take care of yourself, get a mani-pedi, just get a massage, talk to a friend, take a walk. Whatever you need to do to just keep grounding yourself and nurturing yourself, too.
One thing I would say with adding a time element to that is I've studied hundreds of people's logs of how they spend their time. Working parents often spend more time with their families than they give themselves credit for. It's because the time isn't happening at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, and we have this story in our minds that the only time that counts that parents spend with their children is at 10 a.m. on Tuesday. And so if you're not doing that, well, I'm clearly not with my kids. But then you look at stuff like, well, okay, a kid was up at like 5:30 in the morning and I left for work at 8. Well, that was 2.5 hours that we were kind of around each other, but why am I not even thinking that that time exists? Well, it does. It can be used. You can do something with it. You know, there's time on weekends, there's time in the evenings, there's days off school. I mean, I have people keep track of their time, they look at it and they go, oh, I used to feel guilt. I don't feel guilt anymore.
You know, I have 2 boys who play, they're athletes, and they're, you know, young adults now that are senior in high school, freshman in college. And you know, I'll come home from like a tied up week or an ugly meeting and I'm like grinding my teeth and pouring wine. And they're like, you know, why do you, you know, they'll ask, I remember my younger one, Billy, asked me, he's like, why do you do this? And I'm like, this is my lacrosse. Like, I know that you come off the field sometime and you are grinding your teeth and grumpy and, you know, you lost today. And I go, but you're going back out there tomorrow, aren't you, darling?
Yeah.
And so, do not feel guilty about that. That's their balance. That's their balance. That's not your balance. Right? This word balance, I have angst with it.
Doesn't exist.
We're measuring up to, you know, leave it to Cleaver still, right? And that's not what balance is anymore. And, you know, what is happy for you and what your happy meter is and what's going for you is not hers or his or anyone else's.
The other thing that I had to learn is you're not, like, perfect at being the mother either, right? The story I always tell is, I think my children have a whole other level of security that they wouldn't have had if I was home with them every day because I am perennially late. And the woman who took care of them was punctual. She was at that school early every day. They never had to worry, where's mom, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, she was better at that than I would have been. So even though they said, where are you? You're not like the other mothers. But guess what? It helped them, too. So, you know, I think we take on so much in the name of perfection that we don't need to.
Do you want to get one last question in? We have, like, 1 minute.
The only question I had is, how did you all, I know you spoke on balancing out your positivity and your children's accepting your careers and your decisions. What about the people who didn't necessarily support your decisions, but you found them to be the most important people in your life? How did you balance out that negotiation with them?
That's a tough one. First of all, I think you, there's this, my father told me this phrase when I was a young person. We're born into this world alone. And what he means about that, he doesn't mean to terrify us. He only told me, but you have to own, what he was saying was, is own your decisions. And that means that there are times when my dad utterly disagreed with me. I left, I started working for IBM right out of college. I was there for 12 years, had a wonderful career, and I left them. And I thought my father, I know he didn't speak to me for 2 weeks. He was terrified. He thought that was the stupidest, most ignorant thing I could have done. I was young. They were offering these great packages. I was like, I'm buying a condo and getting another gig. But he didn't see it that way. And so I went through that to someone who has long been my hero, and still my hero. And I had to let time pass. Before we could wrestle that topic. So take that angst that's happening in the moment, put it on the shelf, go do what you need to do, and maybe there'll be a time when you can talk about it again, and maybe not. But go do what you need to do, right? They're not, your most favorite, wonderful people aren't gonna be always, you know, giving you the thumbs up, so.
All right. So I just have one quote to end with, if that's okay, that I think answers your question too a little bit. One of my favorite quotes in life is this: Ernest Hemingway said, life breaks everyone and some are stronger in the broken places. And as I was thinking about this whole work-life balance question, to me, as I look back on all these choices and trade-offs in my life, I just think the answer is more like, and some are better in the broken places. So it's going to be hard. But by giving you these examples of, well, I would never pick them up on time at school, you can hopefully get some perspective and feel like, yeah, it's going to be hard. It's not easy. There is no such thing as work-life balance. But you can keep getting better and keep making it better, and it's you're going to do what's good for you.
Great. Thank you very much.
So last word, bookstore, book signing, life-changing. Thank you.
Very good.